From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Tuberculosis is on the rise again in America. On today's Fresh Air, we ask Dr. Barry Bloom why we have a new TB epidemic, why TB has come back in a form that's much more difficult to treat, and who is most at risk. Dr. Bloom is the former head of the World Health Organization's TB Committee. Peter Begg used to do a series of comic books called Neat Stuff, but the name didn't quite fit the spirit. That's why his latest series is called Hate Comics. It features a group of cynical post-college kids who argue over Fritos, TV shows, and rock bands. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new solo album by Lindsey Buckingham of Fleetwood Mac fame. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The 1992 Democratic National Convention is now underway as Democrats gather to nominate their presidential and vice presidential candidates. NPR's Ann Taylor reports from New York.
On time, just about to the minute, party chairman Ron Brown called the convention to order, calling New York the start and the White House the finish. He spoke in Madison Square Garden that is decorated in red, white, and blue, and against a backdrop of huge video screens. This year's color guard was made up of homeless veterans who marched into only a partially filled arena. Before tonight's three keynote speakers, the convention is showcasing six women Democratic candidates for the U.S. Senate. It's the first night of a four-night meeting that will nominate Bill Clinton as the party's presidential candidate and Al Gore as the vice presidential choice. At a convention that party officials hope will indicate a unified Democratic Party, the only former primary rival who so far has not endorsed the ticket is former California Governor Jerry Brown. I'm Ann Taylor reporting from the Democratic National Convention.
The campaign of likely presidential candidate Ross Perot acknowledged today that it has asked electors to sign loyalty oaths. NPR's John Burnett reports.
Under federal law, the party of the presidential candidate who wins the most votes in a given state wins its slate of electors. The losing candidate wins no electors. But Perot apparently envisioned this nightmare. Suppose a candidate had no party and the electors pledged to him began to defect, or they were spies to begin with. A statement released by Perot's campaign read, "The loyalty of our volunteers or electors has never been questioned. We simply feel it is prudent to obtain oaths from people." Campaign officials were concerned that while the fealty of Democratic and GOP electors is long-standing, Perot volunteers have no history of supporting their candidate. The campaign is requiring that the oaths be notarized. The legality of loyalty oaths has been upheld by the Supreme Court, but their use by Perot has nonetheless reportedly strained relations between the Dallas headquarters and some grassroots activists. I'm John Burnett reporting.
A Baltimore jury has found six companies liable for exposing thousands of workers to cancer-causing asbestos fibers. The verdict came in the largest asbestos trial in the nation's history, which consolidated nearly 9,000 cases filed by shipyard and steel mill workers. The jury made its decision after listening to 4 months of testimony and seeing nearly a million pieces of evidence. The jury had to decide three critical issues: whether each of the six companies was negligent, which products were defective, and when the companies knew that the products were dangerous. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 7 points to close at 3,337. Advances led to declines by a margin of about 10-7 in moderate trading. This is NPR. President Bush said today that he'll send Secretary of State James Baker to the Middle East next week to get the ball rolling again on peace talks. The announcement came after Israel's new Prime Minister, Yitzhak Rabin, offered to go to Arab capitals to pursue peace talks and invited Arab leaders to Jerusalem. President Bush made a congratulatory phone call to Rabin today and said he's invited the new leader to visit him at his summer home in Kennebunkport, Maine, in early August. President Bush has announced that the United States will no longer produce plutonium and highly enriched uranium for weapons. NPR's Ann Garrels has more.
The Bush administration actually stopped producing plutonium 4 years ago, and with large stockpiles on hand and even more expected as thousands of nuclear weapons are dismantled, the administration had no plans to produce more. So the administration's practice today became policy. Officials insisted this will encourage others to follow suit. This was applauded by arms control advocates, though it was generally agreed this move was long overdue. In a list of principles guiding nonproliferation efforts, the president also supported punishments for those who contribute to the spread of weapons of mass destruction and increased funding for special inspections of suspected violators. The U.S. is currently in arrears on its payment for the current inspection regime. The president's statement seemed aimed at bolstering his nonproliferation credentials, an issue he campaigned on 4 years ago. And because of Iraq, this is an issue on which he is vulnerable. I'm Ann Garrels in Washington.
The state of Florida charged today that Southern Bell Telephone Company cheated customers out of at least $14 million by billing them for services they never ordered. Florida Attorney General Bob Butterworth said that the phone company used high-pressure telephone sales techniques to get customers to sign up for optional services. A Southern Bell spokesman said today that he was stunned by the attorney general's charges. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We thought tuberculosis had been contained in America. It was, but it isn't anymore. TB has been on the rise since the mid-80s. In some poor areas of America, the TB rates are higher than those of the poorest countries in the world. A contagious disease like tuberculosis is everyone's problem. So we called Dr. Barry Bloom to find out why TB is on the rise and who is most at risk. Bloom is the former chair of the World Health Organization's TB Committee. He retired from the position in April after serving for 6 years. He's also a professor of microbiology and immunology at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine in New York. TB is a bacterial disease that affects the lungs. Symptoms include persistent coughing, fever, and weight loss. The disease can be deadly if untreated or if the bacteria is resistant to antibiotics. Dr. Bloom told me there are several reasons behind today's tuberculosis epidemic.
I think one has to throw in three reasons. The first is clearly the increase in AIDS. Many people were infected with TB, but only a few developed disease. But when the HIV virus wears down the immune system, then one becomes very vulnerable to tuberculosis. I think the second reason is that there has been a decay in the social structures in the major cities in the United States. Along with the epidemic of AIDS, we have, even preceding it, homelessness, loss of funds for public health resources and social resources in the cities. So we have lots of people crowded into relatively unsanitary circumstances. And then the third reason is the decline in governmental support to maintain public health structures. And public health is designed to prevent diseases. And we're so used to paying to treat diseases once they already happen. We've sometimes forgotten the importance of, and certainly the cost benefits, of preventing people from getting sick. And that requires a public health system with public health nurses and doctors treating people, vaccinating people, providing drugs early on in illness to prevent people from getting sick.
How bad is the epidemic now?
The epidemic, the history of tuberculosis is that TB has declined in the United States for over 70 years, till 1985. And then the curve started to go up, such that there is an excess of about 26,000 cases that has occurred since 1985. And so the curve should have declined as people infected as children age and turn over. But the curve is actually going up. And we believe that that means that there is new transmission of infection within the cities, and more people are being infected than they would have been had we had good treatment and good control of the disease.
Yeah, you've said that the epidemic is a predictable result of abandoning public health measures. What public health measures did we have that we've since abandoned?
We had a system of grants from the federal government, for example, through the Centers for Disease Control, to the states and the cities for maintaining personnel whose job it was to identify people that had or could have tuberculosis, to go into schools and do skin testing of children, to take people who look like they were infected, and you know that when a skin test becomes positive, and provide a very simple drug that prevents disease about 90% of the time. That disappeared in the early 70s. And so the failure of those resources to maintain a team of people who are expert in how to identify the disease, how to find it, how to motivate people to take their preventive therapy, and how to treat it to prevent transmission, fell out in some but not all cities.
Why was that money cut back in the early 70s?
I think it was part of the great retrenchment of federal funds that had been given away to the states for social services and for health purposes. And this was the sense that we wanted to privatize things. And one of the things that's very difficult to privatize is preventing disease, because the real resources turn over in treating disease. And that really, one has to look then, whose role is it to provide preventive programs, education programs in schools to keep kids from getting sick from common illnesses, preventive programs to stop the transmission of infectious diseases, vaccine programs to prevent the 28,000 cases of measles we had in the United States in 1990. And I believe that that can only be the public health system. People pay when they're sick to have themselves treated and made better. It's the public sector, the government requirement, whose job it is to pay for all of us to keep us from getting sick.
And I guess part of the reason why there's a public responsibility for that is if one person gets sick, they spread it to other people, and that's how an epidemic is started.
And that's basically what makes tuberculosis different than many other diseases. If you have a heart condition and don't wish to comply with treatment, the only person really besides your family members that you put at risk, and the only person at medical risk, is yourself. Tuberculosis is a highly infectious disease. And it's of the most dangerous kind because it's transmitted by droplets from coughing, sneezing, or even talking. I like to say that when you ask what is the major risk factor for tuberculosis, the major risk factor is breathing, and there's not much we can do to obliterate that. Consequently, the most important thing in TB is to find people who have the disease at an early stage and treat them properly. And within 2 weeks to a month, they cease to be infectious and they can no longer transmit the disease. And the fact that we believe there is active transmission going on means there are lots of people who have the disease and are not picked up, have nowhere to go, may not even know they have it, and are not being treated or forced to maintain their treatment so that they can be cured.
Is this different from the way it used to be when there were tuberculosis epidemics? Are we having more trouble finding and treating people who have it and are spreading it?
Yes and no. We had in the old days no tools, no drugs to cure anybody of TB or prevent TB. And in fact, what we had was the necessity to have sanatoria where people mostly voluntarily, in fact, went and became isolated from society, which had a huge public health impact, which is it minimized the transmission of disease. And then either one lived or died, and the percentage of survivals, so-called case fatality rate, of untreated tuberculosis in the United States or anywhere else in the world is about 50%. So half the people made it on their own by virtue of their own immunity, and the other 50% simply died. The difference now is that we have, or up until very recently with the emergence of multi-drug resistant strains, we have very good drugs for TB. The cure rates for TB for people who take those drugs appropriately is about 95 to 98% in the United States. And I should add, that case cure rate is about the same whether you're HIV positive or not. So the key thing to prevent transmission and to cure the disease is make sure people get those drugs, but more importantly, take them for a period of 6 to 9 months. And that's where the real problem has come in. It's very difficult when someone feels better after taking drugs for a month to encourage them or persuade them that they should take 3 drugs, many capsules and pills, over a 6 or 9 month period. And when they start to feel good, they stop taking their pills. And that's the new dimension that has been added to the current situation. Not only do they relapse again after 3 or 6 months with active TB, not only do they spread the disease, but as they go on and off the medication, it's a perfect scenario for selecting for drug-resistant tuberculosis. So that if you look at the isolates, for example, of TB bacilli in New York City last year, 1 out of 3 was resistant to 1 or more antibiotics. And when they get resistant to 2, we really don't have nearly so good backup or second-line drugs, it becomes a major problem. And when they become resistant to five or six, the case fatality rate is about the same as it is in totally untreated disease. 50% die.
So in other words, people who don't really understand antibiotics and who aren't seeing a doctor regularly, by not taking their medicine after the symptoms disappear, they're breeding a more resistant version of tuberculosis.
Absolutely correct. And had they taken their pills, these organisms would not have existed.
So now what's the challenge to medical professionals now to try to get the drugs to people and to convince them to take it?
The challenge is enormous. The challenge is, at the first level, to make access to those drugs available to everybody. For example, in New York City, which really does have an epidemic, if a third of the samples are resistant to one of the major drugs, and if you have 4,000 new cases, or almost that, last year in New York, how do you make sure, for example, that a working person has access to a city clinic that can get those drugs? There is no clinic in New York City open after 5 o'clock at night, and the waits are often very long. That's not a scenario to encourage people to come get their drugs and take them for 6 months. There are many people who are homeless, who live in shelters, who are on the street, who have barely enough to survive on and barely enough to eat. Not easy to tell them to eat pills instead of food. So the challenge really is to make it possible to reach those people and provide an incentive for them to want to continue the course of treatment. The incentive to the system is very clear, not only to cure the individual case, but to prevent the much greater costs as those infections are transmitted from non-compliant patients to the normal population.
What kind of incentives are possible to provide people to get them to take their drugs?
We don't really know. In Denver, there were wonderful studies that if you simply provided coffee and food, donuts, breakfast, lunches, people came with a 90% regularity who had failed and repeatedly failed taking their drugs over time. And so there is some reason to believe that reaching people would solve part of the problem. And for those that really need more than that, incentives would provide for another part of the problem. But I have to say, we all recognize that there is a very small segment that is simply unlikely, once they feel well, to continue taking their medicine. And that poses major social and ethical issues to everybody.
What kinds of issues?
There is a possibility in most states that people who are infectious represent a threat to the public health. And there are laws on the books of most states that say they can be detained, often against their will, if the Department of Health or the legal advisory bodies believe that's necessary. Nobody likes forced detention. Nobody likes to force people to take their medication. But the threat to the public health versus the civil liberties of an individual is a major issue that is being debated all across the country in medical circles concerned with TB.
Well, I know with AIDS, the issue came up earlier in the epidemic. Should people who have AIDS be quarantined? Is the issue of quarantine coming up with tuberculosis?
Yes and no. The first point is, I think that was a silly issue. If you look historically at quarantine in the United States, even for infections coming in from overseas, they never worked. So quarantine as a public health measure is more a political face-saving measure than it is an epidemiologically effective measure. What one does with patients, any patients with active tuberculosis, first and foremost, if they come for treatment, is to put them in a circumstance where they cannot transmit the disease to anyone else. That means two things. One is a medical facility which is called respiratory isolation or containment, a facility in which they are in a closed environment, preferably ventilated, possibly with germs that can be killed by UV lights, such that they can't infect the medical personnel, the nursing personnel, the prison personnel, or their fellow patients, perhaps most importantly. And that is not quarantine. That is good medical practice. If drugs are given, then usually within a couple weeks, they cease to be infectious and then do not have to stay for the remainder of their 6 months in any kind of medical facility, provided that they are willing and able to take their drugs on a regular basis.
Dr. Barry Bloom is my guest. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Barry Bloom. He chaired the Tuberculosis Committee for the World Health Organization for 6 years. He's also a professor of microbiology and immunology at Albert Einstein College of Medicine in New York. I just want to clarify something before we go any further, and that is, how easy is it to contract tuberculosis from somebody who has it? I mean, if you walk past somebody who's coughing and has tuberculosis, does that mean you're likely to get it?
Favorite question that everyone always asks. It's usually formulated in, can I catch TB from riding the bus? And one of the curiosities of TB is that it's very unpredictable. We know it's transmitted in small droplet nuclei, tiny things that float around in the air and don't settle out. So in fact, there is a real possibility for anybody who is in the same airspace with a patient with tuberculosis to catch TB. The likelihood really is not very great for most people in public transport or any circumstance where there's ventilation. One of the important things the sanatoria did is they, for perhaps crazy reasons, thought that fresh air was beneficial and decided to open all the windows, even in the very northern parts of New York State. That opening of the windows, forget the cold air and the fresh air, ventilated out those air droplets, and it's a very good way of diluting them such that they become very unlikely to infect. On the other hand, there is the circumstance of a school in St. Louis you may have read about in the newspapers in 1990 where a single teacher who did not have HIV disease infected 175 elementary school students. That's more than half of the entire students in the school. Didn't know he had tuberculosis, thought he had a smoker's cough. So its problems with the risks are that they're unpredictable.
Now, I know you just got back from visiting Rikers Island Prison.
I did.
In New York. What were you looking for there?
Clearly, prisons are one of those places where people are in very close contact, and the people who are taken into prisons are people who one knows very little about their medical experience or history. So there's a terrifically high risk that some of them may be infected with TB or doubly infected with TB and HIV and possibly have active disease. And there have been notable outbreaks, one a couple months ago just outside of Washington, where over 100 prisoners were infected with tuberculosis from a single active patient who was not picked up. I must say that the activity at Rikers Island Prison, which is just next to LaGuardia Airport in New York, has been really remarkable. The problem was recognized as a potential disaster immediately. A high number of the prisoners there are HIV positive, and the consequences of their being infected with TB is almost 100% fatal unless treated adequately. So a brand new disease control unit, state of the art, has just opened. It was built in 90 days under court order, where patients have rooms with very good filtered ventilation, each a separate room, each a telephone, and each a television set. So this is hardly quarantine in the sense that you would have used it in the past. And they have double doors that protect the hospital workers, but still enable the people to be examined and treated until they are no longer infectious. And then they can be continued to be treated, but in a regular prison facility. As of the moment it opened in June, my understanding is that the men's facility, they no longer even have enough units for all the patients that are demanding such facilities.
What kind of health leadership do you think we need right now?
Well, I think if I am not really qualified to make general statements politically, But my sense is, after the election of Senator Wofford from Pennsylvania on a campaign that said personal security in the area of health is perhaps as or more important than national security, has really, and the high costs of medical care and the high costs of government contributions to medical care, I hope have put the issue of health on the agenda. Our public health in this country is really remarkably poor, given the wealth of this country. I cite one other example, not TB. In Vietnam, in Uganda, in Tanzania, in Salvador, over 80% of the kids under the age of two receive their childhood vaccines. In Houston, Texas, that number is 15%. In the Bronx in New York, where I work, that number is 35%. There is nothing cheaper in preventing disease and death in the entire world than giving childhood vaccinations. And the fact that we cannot mobilize the resources to do that is a tremendous indictment of the priorities in this country.
Are we falling behind third world countries in our health care?
Behind third world countries. Let me give you another figure. Mozambique, Malawi, Benin, Nicaragua have tuberculosis control programs in which not only do over 80 to 85% of the patients complete treatment, but they are cured after follow-up for 2 years. In the United States of America, we do not have any data on follow-up. We do have data on case completion rates, that is, the ability of people to take 6 months' worth of drugs in the major cities. Some cities do very well, over 90%. Overall, many cities, including New York, do very poorly, on the order of 50%. Perhaps most tragic and most pinpointing the threat to communities is in a study of 224 consecutive patients at Harlem Hospital who had tuberculosis. After 6 months, only 11% had taken their medication and had completed treatment. That means 89% of those people left capable of spreading the disease and probably developing drug resistance. That's the tragedy of the major cities in this country.
What do you see when you look ahead?
I always see hope when I look ahead. And the sense that maybe the only way to prove that it pays to invest in preventing disease is to add up the costs of having that disease. So we've been working with two economists, one from New York, one from Harvard, to try to calculate the costs of not doing TB right. That is, had we done it right, the curve of TB would continue to go down for the last 70 years to a very low level, and we would eliminate it, basically, as a public health problem. But that increment, that excess cases of 26,000 people, that has a cost. That costs in drugs, that costs $1,000 a day in New York for hospitalization. And those costs, by the end of the decade, as it stands now, are going to add up to billions of dollars. We know that already. Not counting the infrastructure, the $62 million to build a prison here and a prison here and a prison here and a long-term care facility here, there, and elsewhere, we're going to be paying many, many billions of dollars. And maybe it will register that it would have been a lot cheaper to have had a good public health infrastructure and not have the money go in and out with each fashion. Diseases don't go in and out of fashion unless we make them so.
Well, Dr. Bloom, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
It was my pleasure.
Dr. Barry Bloom is a professor of microbiology and immunology at Albert Einstein College of Medicine in New York. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Cartoonist Peter Bagg spends his time drawing Buddy Bradley, a white middle-class American male who'd rather sit around arguing about his favorite TV shows than take advantage of his privileged status and get a job. Actually, he recently got a job managing a grunge rock band. Now he resents the popularity of the musicians he's managing. Coming up, we'll talk to Peter Bagg about his latest comic book series, Hate. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Out of the Cradle, the new solo album by Lindsey Buckingham of Fleetwood Mac fame. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The 1992 Democratic Convention is formally underway. The 41st Quadrennial Gathering was gaveled open by party chairman Ron Brown. He began speaking just after 5 Eastern Time in New York City's Madison Square Garden. The convention is set to officially nominate Arkansas Governor Bill Clinton as its candidate for president and Tennessee Senator Albert Gore Jr. as its vice presidential candidate. Some 4,928 delegates chosen in primary elections, party caucuses, and other procedures are on hand for the event. Chairman Brown says the convention's goal is to present the country with a new set of leaders who can bring the kind of change the country needs. Bill Clinton took time away from his speech preparation today to visit a community service organization begun at the turn of the century. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
This morning, Clinton went for a jog in Central Park, then headed for the Lower East Side and the Henry Street Settlement House. He visited with homeless mothers, teenagers taking a workshop in racial harmony, and kids in an environmental awareness class. Clinton is expected to weave the story of his humble beginnings into the acceptance speech he'll give on Thursday night. Today, he gave his personal history a kind of test run when he took questions at a town meeting outside the settlement house. Clinton told the crowd that he understood the average person's problems because he'd been poor as a child. "I know what it's like not to have enough money to get along," he said. Clinton does not plan to go to Madison Square Garden tonight. He'll spend the rest of the day in his hotel room giving broadcast interviews and working on his speech. In New York, I'm Mara Liasson.
President Bush is moving quickly to strengthen relations with the new Israeli government of Yitzhak Rabin. Alan Dowd has more from Kennebunkport.
The White House says President Bush called Rabin to congratulate him on his victory and the formation of the new Israeli government. The White House says Secretary of State James Baker will be dispatched to Israel and its Arab neighbors next week to get the ball rolling again in the peace process. The White House statement said Rabin told Mr. Bush he wants to give the peace process new momentum. The Rabin government is much more supportive of the U.S.-backed peace talks than was his predecessor, Yitzhak Shamir. The leaders may soon be getting together for a personal meeting. The president has also invited Rabin to visit him in Kennebunkport in early August. Mr. Bush is scheduled to be at his vacation home in the week leading up to the Republican convention. The White House says Mr. Bush told Rabin he looks forward to deepening the U.S.-Israeli partnership and promoting the peace with security that the Israelis want. For National Public Radio, I'm Alan Dowd in Kennebunkport.
Stock prices closed higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 6.75 points to close at 33.37.31. Advances led declining issues by a margin of about 10 to 7. Trading was moderate. Approximately 149 million shares changed hands. This is NPR. German authorities have transferred convicted hijacker Mohammed Hamadi to the same jail where his brother is serving a sentence on terrorism charges. Deidre Berger reports from Frankfurt.
State justice officials say the switch in jails is a consequence of the release in Lebanon last month of 2 German hostages. Islamic extremists held the 2 men captive for 3 years in hopes of forcing the release of the Hamadi brothers, who were imprisoned in Germany on hijacking, murder, and kidnapping charges. The Bonn government denies making concessions or payments to the Islamic kidnappers to obtain the release of the 2 Germans. The German officials did promise to review the prison conditions of the 2 Hamadi brothers. At the request of the Bonn government, Hessen state officials agreed to transfer Mohammed to the jail in Saarbrücken, where his brother Abbas is imprisoned. This week's edition of Der Spiegel News magazine claims that Iran arranged the German hostage release last month after Bonn uncovered a spy in the Iranian embassy in Bonn. For National Public Radio, this is Deidre Berger in Frankfurt.
Ross Perot dismissed the only advertising firm working with his undeclared presidential campaign today. This is seen as a blow to campaign co-manager Ed Rollins, who hired the agency. It's also seen as a sign of Perot's tight grip on decision-making and strategy. Perot is said to be resisting pressure to hurry ads onto TV and to freshen his stump speech. He is trying to mend fences with African Americans after referring to them as "you people" in a weekend speech to the NAACP. A former housing and urban development aide pleaded not guilty today to charges she steered millions in federal contracts to favored developers and then lied about the matter to Congress. Deborah Gordine was executive assistant to former HUD Secretary Samuel Pierce between 1984 and 1987. She's accused of using her job to enrich herself, five consultants, and the developers they worked for. The consultants are unnamed and unindicted. No trial date for Dean has been set. This is National Public Radio News from Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Peter Bagg's comic book series, Hate, has been described as a chronicle of lowlife culture and style. The main character is a loser named Buddy Bradley. He's cynical, paranoid, and lazy, somewhere between a knowledgeable hipster and a bitter crank. The latest development in Buddy's life is he's gotten a job managing a grunge rock band in Seattle. Seattle is also home to the artist Peter Bagg. Bagg has been at work in the world of underground comics since Punk magazine first accepted his work in 1979. Soon after, R. Crumb asked Bagg to edit Weird magazine. Then in 1985, the publishers Fantagraphics gave Bagg his own series, Neat Stuff. He's since turned down proposals to make his characters into a TV show. He even turned down an offer to write for The Simpsons. I asked Bagg how he came up with the main character in Hate Comics, Buddy Bradley.
Well, it was based partly on myself and partly on a lot of friends of mine from my high school days. He's based on myself to the extent that I could at least empathize with everything that he says and does. But I used a lot of people I knew more as a prototype. He's more typical of them rather than me, simply because a lot of my friends had much larger chips on my shoulders than I did. So they'd be inclined to act before they thought and say all these horrible things that they, whether they really believed it or not, as far as making sexist or racist comments, was kind of besides the point. It was just all how reflective of their incredibly bad attitudes and attitude towards life. He started out as part of the Bradley family, which again was based on my family and families in my neighborhood, your typical dysfunctional family, I guess, to use an overused term. I just got tired of writing about the Bradley family and decided to age Buddy Bradley a bit and make him a young pseudo-bohemian type living in an inner city and hanging out with his friends. And that's pretty much what Hate is based on.
Yeah, and how did you come up with the title of Hate for the series, Hate Comics?
It's partly a reaction to the comic book I was doing previously, which, as you mentioned, was called Neat Stuff. And even though the material in Neat Stuff was pretty adult, pretty cynical, there sometimes would be some confusion with people thinking it would be more of a friendly, lighthearted comic, or at worst, a kiddie comic, just because its title was Neat Stuff, which now I understand is the name of a line of pretty sappy greeting cards. So part of it was an overreaction to make it clear as to what kind of material to expect. And plus, I wanted to stay within the tradition of humor comics of keeping a short, snappy name that's pretty easy to remember. Plus, a lot of my friends, when I first decided to call it Hate, they were a little worried that people would think that there's some kind of neo-Nazi slant to it, and they'd have to make excuses to their friends for associating with me. But surprisingly, that's never happened. I've never gotten any flack for the comic book being called Hate, which I guess was a bit of a disappointment. We thought we could maybe milk some publicity out of that, but it hasn't worked.
And Hate number one, you know, the first in the series, you cynically refer to yourself as Mr. Negative Energy himself.
Right. Well, I guess just with the comic book Hate and with calling it Hate and with people asking me why, that was my stock answer, so that I'm Mr. Negative Energy, so I just threw that in there.
I'd like our listeners to see your drawing, but short of that, I think you'd probably do a better job at describing it than I would.
Drawing my cartooning style?
Mm-hmm.
Well, real rubbery, I guess, would be the best way to to describe it. It's very cartoony, you know, lots of big noses, and nobody has elbows or knees. I used to try to work that in there with bent elbows and knees, but it always seemed to get in the way with what I was trying to say. So now that seems to be a trademark that people always point out, is that all my characters' limbs curve and sway all over the place. And all my characters also, as a result, tend to be pretty thin, just because it's easier to move them around. And also, I guess my comics are noted for the way that when two people, their arguments or whatever is going on between them comes to a head, they tend to almost physically blow up, or their heads and mouths just grow to huge proportions. As time goes by, I worry less and less about keeping things in proportion, and am not afraid to exaggerate as much as I feel gets the point across.
If you're just joining us, my guest is comic strip artist Peter Bagg, and his series include Hate Comics. Earlier on, he did the Bradleys and Neat Stuff. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. I guess this comic artist, Peter Bagg. Let me get you to describe your character of Studs Kirby.
Well, when I first started doing comics in earnest, this is going back 14 years ago when I was still in art school, he was one of two characters I was working with regularly, and that reflected two sides of my personality. And with him, again, it was almost like I don't work with him anymore because he's not too different from Buddy and his friends, where, again, he wears his heart on his sleeve. And he's very politically incorrect, just says and does all the things that all of us maybe in our worst moments might think, but that most of us don't do. But he just wouldn't hold back. And because he was so boisterous, eventually it seemed just a natural to make him a talk show host. And again, originally, too, I kind of exaggerated his whole routine on the radio as far as being a talk show host, of being, needless to say, pretty right-wing, but real fuzzy about his ideology. But it would be fuzzy to a listener, but not to him. He thought he had everything all figured out, and it would be very bombastic. And I used to worry that he was too much of an exaggeration, but since then, I can remember while I was still working with him, Morton Downey came out with his television show, and I saw that, and I thought, this guy makes my cartoon character look like a regular human. Like, compared to my comic character, Morton Downey is much more of a cartoon character. And since then, it seems like there's been an explosion of outrageous talk show hosts that it almost put my character to shame. He seemed a little too tame.
One of the things I love about Studs Kirby is, you know, he relaxes to Pete Fountain Records, and his favorite singers are Brenda Lee and Doris Day. Uh-huh. Is this another side of you musically?
Well, yeah. I guess almost the way you would say that he says and does things that I might think but wouldn't readily admit to, or it's part of my behavior, my control. Also, the music he listens to is music that I don't exclusively listen to, but I do enjoy. But I have to be pretty selective about when and to who I might bring it up, saying, oh, I love Bert Kampfert. Half the time you have to explain who he is. It's also a bit based on my father, too, who didn't necessarily listen to those women singers, but he listened to music of that type, and he loved Bert Kampfert. When I was a kid, I hated Bert Kampfert because I heard it coming from the downstairs in the middle of the night all the time, but, you know, the apple never falls far from the tree, and I listen to a lot of music now that my father used to listen to.
Well, I'm not going to speak on behalf of Bert Kampfert, but I will say, you know, you have a sympathetic ear here with Doris Day.
Oh, yeah, great voice. Yeah, she was, again, yeah. That was somebody that, when I was young, those movies...
Awful.
It would make me rich. Now mm-hmm. I think they're a riot. And also just...
Well, some of her early records are really good.
Right, and even her sappiest records that, again, used to drive me up the wall when I was younger, one day just dawned on me, she has a beautiful voice. It's like her image... is so dominant in the culture, people think so much of her as being so, squeaky clean that it obscures the fact that she has a stunning voice, at least in my opinion.
And in the inside of the cover, you often show off somebody else's art.
Right.
And you make recommendations of some of your favorites, and you've got a sketch in one of them of the Kirby Stone 4.
Right.
who had the real, like, Squaresville version of Bubbles, Bangles, and Beads.
Right, right. that's another group that...
Your dad loved.
That just, he didn't have, I'm sure he liked it because he would listen to those corny stations where they'd play them a lot. And again, they would drive me up the wall. And then all of a sudden one day it just hit me. And I just once jokingly said that I liked the Kirby Stone 4 in an editorial. And that led to a bunch of tapes. People sent me a whole bunch of tapes. And then I became a connoisseur of them. Although something that's very disappointing is when you hear that particular record, Baubles, Spangles, and Beads, which was their biggest hit, it sounds like there's 40 people singing instead of 4, and there's a lot of women singing. And I always thought the women's voices really made the record. And it turns out there aren't any women in the Kirby Stone 4, that they didn't get any credit or anything. So it's kind of a shame. So for that reason, I kind of, at this point, kind of hate them. Because they use these anonymous women to give themselves a hit record. When they sing with just the 4 of them, they don't sound so good.
I think it was your character of Buddy who once worked for Muzak or almost worked for Muzak.
Right.
Did you ever have a job like that, identifying songs?
Again, no, I didn't. But again, I was trying to think of a dopey job that might have driven him crazy, just using it as an example in that story. And again, so many people in this town, like the fellows I was referring to before who work for Sub Pop, and a lot of the musicians here, they work for a local factory that makes the Muzak tapes that you hear in... stations. And they tend to, again, they take the job as a joke. They figure, well, I could work at Burger King, but wouldn't it be hilarious if I made Muzak tapes for a living? Since, you know, when I go home, I listen to all this noisy rock and roll. And of course, it does wind up driving some of them nuts. They just can't take it anymore. But it's also amazing how many of them have been working there for years. They wind up loving it. So I guess, you know, they'll probably wind up just listening exclusively to Bert Kampfert like I did.
How old were you when you started cartooning? I don't mean professionally, but when you just started doing it on your own.
Well, I did it off and on quite a bit for as long as I could remember. And my main reason for doing it was simply because my older brother did it. He was a real natural. And in fact, I tend to think that because cartooning, just doing simple, amusing type comic strips and gags came so easy to him that he never really developed any work habits towards it, whereas I did. I always had to work twice as hard to be half as good as he was. So eventually he just got bored of it, whereas I continued to grind away. And I did get sidetracked quite a bit, as a lot of cartoonists do when I entered art school. Everybody seems to, all the teachers there, try to steer you away from comics and anything else, fine art or even illustration. But so I tried hard to see if I could make it at anything else, illustration or whatever. But the only thing I had any inkling for, not only artistically, but for anything, I was always been completely unemployable except for doing comics. So I do this by default. I don't have any options.
Let me get back to your comics about Buddy. You ran a Buddy look-alike contest.
Right.
And you asked your readers to do what?
Just send in a picture, of course. More than one, preferably, and just keep write a short description, or actually, I said, as long as they wanted, just explaining why they're just like Buddy Bradley. And originally, I got like hardly any responses. They were coming in really slow. I thought the contest was going to be a dud, but again, in typical Buddy Bradley fashion, they all waited to the very last minute, and then I got tons and tons of entries, and it was pretty horrifying to open up envelope after envelope of all these guys that look just like Buddy Bradley with their hair in their face. And some of them got testimonials from past employers talking about, you know, what a ne'er-do-well this guy was. And it was like they actually called up a guy that fired them to type up a letter about how they were the worst employee they ever had. And they'd send it to me. Their girlfriends would write testimonials about how cheap and lazy they are. The final winner, though, was a guy. He lives in New York City, works for Tower Records, and his testimonial was all he wrote was, "I am just like Buddy Bradley because I am just like Buddy Bradley," which may sound like a cop-out, but it kind of also fit the description of being pretty lazy. And his picture, it's going to be the cover of number 10, and it's horrifying. I guarantee you that if you'll find it impossible to believe that this is a real human being. He looks so much like this character. Every time I show it to the picture of this guy to people, they just go, oh, my God.
I think what he wrote you sounds almost like a Zen cone, you know?
Right.
Yeah. In its simplicity and elliptical nature.
Right.
So listen, you're a father now. You live in the suburbs, right?
Well, I live in a house. It's in the city of Seattle, but I guess coming from when people visit us from New York City, they say it's the suburbs. Right. So yeah.
Is Buddy going to become a father?
Well, I really like to put a lot of distance between what's happening to me in my life now and what I do in comics. Like, for example, I'm 34 now, and Buddy is Bradley, the person I'm doing stories about now, is roughly 24. So I like to put a lot of distance between what's happening to me and when I write about it. Just I could laugh about it a bit better, view it more objectively. And yeah, everybody keeps saying, are we going to see a lot of cute kitty comics from you? And no, because she's not two yet. And being a dad, it's still not that funny. She's a real handful. So I figure if I'm ever going to do anything with about little kids, it's going to be a while.
Does this help you live your life without wondering what kind of comic it's going to make, since you have a distance between what you're cartooning about and what you're living?
Well, the stories build up. Like, even when something happens to me, I might say there's a story in this. But if the story is worth doing, if it's a worthwhile story idea, it'll stay with me. I used to even write the ideas down, but that just wasn't necessary anymore. I've found out that if a story was really worth doing, it would stay with me for a long time. And it just seems, usually 5-10 years down the road, it'll just seem like the time is right to put it down on paper.
Listen, after the Buddy Bradley lookalike contest, did you have this kind of sick feeling that you were encouraging the wrong thing in your readers, that they were taking things maybe a little too literally?
No. Well, I haven't met, fortunately, many of these people. It seems pretty obvious to me that they realize it's a joke. And I'm sure they combed their hair a little different or exaggerated just to fit the description. But at the same time, too, I'm sure that they were exactly like my character even before they started reading my book or entered this contest. So, yeah, I'm ducking all responsibility.
Well, Peter Begg, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Okay, well, thank you very much for having me.
Comic book artist Peter Begg lives in Seattle. His current series, Hate Comics, is published by Fantagraphics. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert, what are you doing to look ahead to the opening of the Democratic Convention tonight?
Well, we'll be hearing from Linda Wertheimer, who's up there at the convention. Also today, Nina Totenberg reports on some disgruntled Jerry Brown delegates to the Democratic Convention. An interview with Hillary Clinton, wife of the soon-to-be nominee of the party. And also, we'll be hearing from Daniel Pinkwater as he attempts to cover, for the first time for him, a national political convention. Also today, a talk with the man who'll be throwing out the ceremonial first pitch at tomorrow's baseball All-Star game, Ted Williams.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Lindsey Buckingham is now acknowledged as the brains behind Fleetwood Mac in its most popular incarnation during the late 70s and early 80s. Rock critic Ken Tucker says Buckingham's eccentric melodies and arrangements helped make the group the most interesting superstar band of its era. Now, after a silence of 5 years, Buckingham is back with a new solo album entitled Out of the Cradle. Ken has this review.
Diamonds in the sunset. Now your time has come. A pretty yellow bird fly away into the sun. Don't look down.
Lindsey Buckingham is one of the very few pop musicians who gives self-indulgence a good name. He plays nearly every note on Out of the Cradle, but he hasn't created a musty, selfish, hermetic piece of work. Out of the Cradle glows with the passion of a lonely guy sitting in his room, creating art that he fervently hopes will connect with real people.
Now that someone is dead and gone.
Buckingham was born in Palo Alto, and he follows a line of California loners and eccentric romantics, not just the Beach Boys' Brian Wilson, the obvious comparison, but also novelists like Nathaniel West and John Fante, a painter like Richard Diebenkorn, artists who use their sophistication and intelligence to deny intellectual solutions in life, who place enormous importance on impulse and instinct in nightmares and daydreams. The title of Buckingham's album is taken from Walt Whitman, Out of the Cradle, Endlessly Rocking. But while Buckingham does his share of rocking out on this collection, I like to think he really is thinking of a gently rocking cradle, and that one of his goals has been to create adult lullabies without coyness or undue sentimentality. If that's at least part of what he intended, he's certainly succeeded. This is the loveliest pop album of the year.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Lindsey Buckingham's Out of the Cradle. Fresh Air's senior producer today is Fred Landerl. Our engineers this week are Audrey Voblaitis and Thad Kirk. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Just say with me say we'll meet again. Everyone sees the tear in the sea, but talks about the weather. And everyone pays a price for these dreams, so why not dream say we'll meet again when the sunset spell is gone. When please say we'll meet again.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Drugs and Violence. We'll talk to the director, co-writer, and star of the new movie One False Move about drug-dealing killers and the cops who are stalking them. Then we'll hear from anthropologist Terry Williams, who spent 4 years in a crack house doing research for his new book. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.
Snyder. That's Earth Talk this Tuesday at noon here on 91 FM in Philadelphia.